Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Gardening is a hobby where you can't always follow an instruction manual. With the temperature fluctuating and rain being unpredictable, it's nearly impossible to know, truly, how to make your harvest fruitful in an exact way. Plus, the world will throw you a curveball from time to time, like wildfire smoke and a parasite in the lettuce. But we have two guests today who can help make your garden successful, or at least they're going to try to make sense of it all. Here to answer some gardening questions, we have Mike Hogan, an extension educator and associate professor of agriculture and natural resources at Ohio State University. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thank you.
And also with us is Deb Kanapke, author, educator, and Ohio's Garden Sage. Welcome back, Deb.
Nice to be here.
So by now, everyone has heard of the unfortunate parasite that's plaguing our leafy greens. Some people have even stopped eating vegetables and fruits altogether as a precaution. Mike, I saw that the OSU Extension Office posted on Facebook about this and wanted to offer some information. So what are you telling people about their lettuce? Can they eat it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main message that we were hearing, particularly from our food science folks and our nutrition folks, is ceasing to consume fresh fruits and vegetables. Fruits and vegetables in general was probably not a great idea, you know, from a health perspective. And that we did have some questions from folks, whether the lettuce in their garden or other crops were susceptible to this parasite. And basically, the answer is the risk is incredibly minor, specifically from this particular, foodborne illness. And we've been for the past probably 10 years or so here in Columbus and other urban areas in Ohio. We've developed a program called GAPS, Good Agricultural Practices for Urban Growers, for gardeners and even vegetable growers in urban farms and other urban areas, that helps them understand and identify and minimize the risks from microbes that are common to fruits and vegetables, to growing, to marketing, to transporting those. We've also worked with farmers market managers to help them understand how they can work with growers to make sure that the food is safe. And probably the biggest pinch point for most folks in an urban area, and there are some really different risks of growing food in an urban area compared to more conventional rural production systems of vegetables and fruits. But the most common source of contamination is typically water. And so we really hit that hard with gardeners and urban growers to make sure that they are using only potable water, not just to grow food crops, but to when they harvest, when they wash their hands, when they wash garden tools, to make sure that we're only using potable water, never using surface water. Rainwater can also be questionable. We like to harvest rainwater. We can cut down on the cost of irrigation by harvesting rainwater. But, whatever's on the roof will end up in the rain barrel. And so if there's birds up there, you know what you're going to have if you have birds.
Use your rain barrel water maybe for the rest of your yard and
absolutely.
Not the eating part.
Absolutely. Water your box, wood your lilacs, water the lawn during droughts. Or if you're going to use that water, we do recommend sanitizing it before we use it for irrigation.
Deb, when you keep hearing all the news about cyclospora, this parasite being in the lettuce, I mean, what does that make you think? Does that make you worry for people's lettuce, or how worried do you get?
Not especially for the home gardener or the farm markets or whatever. They are really aware of these issues. Now, you may have a newbie who maybe not be aware of it, but I don't know where the infection came from, where the parasite came from, but it's not in my lettuce in my garden. It's not in, we have been buying our lettuce and our greens still at the farmer's market and been eating it, and we've been fine. There's a specific point of infection. What that is, maybe we'll find it, maybe we won't, but it's not in our gardens.
Do you know, Mike, if this parasite is like always around, but we're just hearing about it more now? Is it a common thing?
It is fairly common. And public health officials say that it's common every season for folks to get the cyclosporiasis. Mm-hmm. What is different now is the level of impact and infection. It is a very common organism. It is only in humans. It is typically spread through water or exposure to feces. And so it's not uncommon, for it to get from into the environment, into the soil and onto plants. But just the level of impact is what is different this year.
So, Deb, for those avoiding lettuce right now, what would you recommend? Maybe just trying to they're too late to grow their own, maybe, but they could go to the farmer's market instead mm-hmm. of buying at the grocery store. Is that what you'd recommend?
I would. But, you know, it's really not too late because it's time to start seeding for your fall crops.
Oh.
We are at August 3rd, and usually August 15th is when I sow my fall lettuce seeds. I already have some kale coming up, some volunteer kale from plants that I grew in the spring, and I let some seed just to see what would happen. And I already have a crop of kale that's about 10 inches tall.
Oh.
So, and something I'd like to bring up, and I'm glad you brought it up, Mike, is that it is a human parasite. So if you're using horse manure, cow manure, chicken manure, you're not going to have this parasite. So if you're using that in your gardens. Yep.
Now, there are other concerns with manures.
Of course.
We cover that
with
the agricultural practices.
Yeah.
Is
right.
How to use those manures. Mm-hmm. It's best if we completely compost them.
Yes.
Not compost them in the garden, not close to the garden where mm-hmm. rainwater, you know, could have an impact if they're slope. But yeah, for the most part, I think Deb's hit the nail on the head. You know, urban growers, smaller growers, gardeners, you know, that don't, maybe don't sell their produce, but we always think about, you know, years ago, when we started teaching good agricultural practices to farmers, to vegetable growers here in Ohio, the question was, do we really need to share this with home gardeners? You know, home gardeners typically grow food for themselves. Maybe they share it with their family or their neighbor. But when you think about it, a lot more folks are growing food for others now. We have a lot of master gardeners who grow a lot of food to donate to food pantries, you know, for food insecurity. So it's really important that no matter how big of a grower you are, that you do follow some really best practices to minimize the potential risk from foodborne illness. About 25% of all foodborne illnesses in the United States can be traced back to produce. You know, everybody thinks of more hazardous foods, you know, foods that spoil quickly, milk-based foods, you know, maybe meats, things like that. But nearly a quarter of all foodborne illness comes from produce, fruits and vegetables.
All right. So tell me how you both wash your lettuce. Tell me the method that you, I have a salad spinner, like, but tell me what you use, Deb. Like, how do you wash your lettuce?
So yes, salad spinner. Mm-hmm. I've done that in the past. We have a well on our property. And so I will sometimes swish in the softened water and then rinse in the hard water. And we've been doing that for 42 years, and we've always been okay.
And Mike, how do you wash your lettuce?
I don't wash my lettuce, and my wife faults me for that. But really, the recommendation is if you're buying lettuce, I don't grow lettuce at home. We grow some other things.
Yeah.
But I really like romaine lettuce. There is probably less potential impact specifically from this parasite to different types of leaf lettuces as compared to like iceberg and romaine. I was sad. I go to buy lettuce almost every other day, and I was sad that in my local grocery store, the shelves are almost empty of lettuce. But I'm still buying romaine. If you buy bagged and washed lettuce, you don't have to. You can be sure that it has been washed. So you don't have to wash it. But certainly, you know, experts, food safety experts tell us, you know, certainly rinsing lettuce. If you're buying that iceberg lettuce now, today, or even romaine, especially if you get full heads as opposed to like maybe hearts of romaine, pull off those outer leaves, maybe discard those. Definitely wash the inner beyond those outer leaves as a extra level of a precaution.
Are you going to be washing your romaine when you find it again?
It's been washed.
Okay.
So I wait till my wife leaves the kitchen when I cut up the lettuce for salad.
Do you know why iceberg and romaine are susceptible to it? Because it's a tight bunch?
Yeah, probably the way it's grown and also the way it's washed. You know, it can contaminate leaves that have less access to the parasite being washed off, you know, as compared to our leaf lettuces and other greens and things like that. But, you know, if you think about it, leafy greens are the most, I hate to use the word hazardous, but that's where we see so much food contamination on vegetables is leafy greens. You know, think about past outbreaks with spinach and other type of lettuces.
There's been outbreaks with romaine, but I do love romaine.
I do.
I agree with you. Mm-hmm. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking gardening with Mike Hogan, extension educator at Ohio State University, and Deb Kanapke, author, educator, and Ohio's garden sage. And Ohio, you know, can't catch a break here between a parasite and now wildfire smoke. So talk to me about the impact, Deb, that the recent wildfire smoke that we had air quality alert problems. What does that do to your garden whenever there's the garden's breathing the same air we're being mm-hmm. cautious about? Yeah.
You know, a big thing is the particulate matter. You might have noticed dust or grittiness mm-hmm. on your food or your ornamental plants. The rain washed most of that off. There are other chemicals that were in the atmosphere, whether they're taken up by the plants. That's a question I have. Mm-hmm. And I have worked a little bit with phytoremediation, which is how plants take up different compounds from the soil, from the air, etc. I don't have a solid answer to that other than for sure I'm washing all my food after the smoke. And I didn't work outside in the garden. On the worst day, I was out watering. I was out for 30 minutes and I came in and I said, I won't do that again because I could feel it in my lungs. So there is a definite issue. And that was in Columbus. I had a friend who was up in Put-in Bay during the worst time, and he said he couldn't see anything. Mm-hmm. You know, he had his students up there, and it was bad. And in that case, you need to be where there's filtered air because it does affect us and animals and insects, and all who are on this earth are affected by the wildfires.
Yeah, Mike, I feel like the wildfire smoke is happening more frequently. You know, we had it happen a few summers ago for many days, and then it just happened a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what do you think about what kind of calls do you get at the Extension Service whenever there's this wildfire smoke and people are asking you questions about it?
So we only had one individual that I know of that was questioning what will be the long-term effects. And you know, we don't have a lot of experience with this. As you say, it's getting more common in different areas of the United States. Climate change is certainly adding to wildfires in different places. Different weather patterns will determine, you know, whether or not we're going to be affected in Ohio. But we do have colleagues at the University of Minnesota and California universities that have studied this a lot because they are obviously much closer to locations where it's common. Wildfires are more common. My son lives in Northern California, and I've been there, you know, during forest fires and wildfires where, you know, when you go out to your car, you have to run the windshield wipers just to get the ash off the windshield. We don't see much of the ash here. We mostly see the effects from aerosols like ozone and ground level ozone. Obviously, we couldn't see downtown Columbus from campus very well as we normally do. So you think there'd be less light available for photosynthesis. Really, research shows that when we have that wildfire smoke, there's actually more diffused light. Okay, so it's more available and actually increased photosynthesis can occur, which is antithetical a little bit. The plant cells on the leaves of plants, the stomata, they're responsible for exchanging gases. You know, they take in carbon dioxide, they produce oxygen. Well, they can also take in the ozone. And what research has found in out west primarily and in other countries like Australia, where wildfires are more common, is that the ozone can depress photosynthesis and also crop growth. It can also cause damage to the foliage, chlorosis, which is, killing of the plant tissue between the veins of the leaf. We haven't seen any of that, here in Columbus. If wildfires become more common in different parts of the country or Canada, and weather patterns are favorable to move the smoke, we may, see that. There are some potato growers, I guess, in Wayne County that were questioning whether or not there would be some effects to potato growth. Potato growers out west have identified not just damage to the foliage above ground, but actually misshapen potatoes from repeated exposure to smoke from wildfire.
Oh no, not potatoes! My favorite. Don't.
I thought they were safe on the ground, right?
Don't mess with potatoes. Yeah. Deb, you mentioned insects, so that leads us to think about the birds, the bees, the pollinators. They are breathing this wildfire smoke too, and they have tiny lungs,
or whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
And I actually went and looked up some information because I was curious as to what would be the effect after watching bald hornets become agitated from a nest, and it's close to my office window on a second story. And I thought, So I started looking at it, and they found a lot of effects, and I'm reading right from what I took off from a Woods and Water News, but reduced birdsong, delayed nesting activity, lower pollinator visitation, reduced bat foraging, altered deer movement, which I thought was interesting, and delayed migration or adaptation to what may happen in the environment. When I put out, you know, good old Facebook, I put out a question, why are the bald hornets going crazy these several days where we had high numbers of smoke? And one person suggested, someone who studies insects, that the chemicals in the smoke was affecting the bald hornets and also causing them not to know where they were.
Oh.
And that is a real interesting idea when you think about it, is the confusion for honeybees or other foraging animals and insects. They're reacting to the chemicals and it's confusing them. So can they get back to their nests, to their hives, to their burrows? So it brings up a lot of questions that we'll be answering probably more in research as time goes by and as we see more wildfires. What is that effect on them and on us?
Yeah, Mike, do you see the Extension Office maybe starting some research on this if the wildfire smoke keeps impacting us more often?
My guess would be yes. Mm-hmm. If there are, you know, we see a lot of research evolves due to climate change and other environmental changes in the environment. So sure, I think that will happen. But there's, like I say, there's a very good base of research, even in some of our Midwestern states. Minnesota is a really good example where they have more proximity to wildfires, mm-hmm. especially the northern part of that state and being sharing a border with Canada. Lots of great research on not just vegetable crops, on field crops, corn and soybeans and other field crops, out west, like wheat and sunflowers. So there is a fairly good research base. But I'm interested, Deb may have picked up on or identified inadvertently a good wildlife control method. You know, if that's if deer don't like wildfire smoke, maybe I need to start a campfire every day about 6 o'clock to keep them out of my garden.
A very controlled fire,
right,
yes.
Right.
Yes. We are talking with Mike Hogan, an extension educator at Ohio State University, and Deb Kanapke, Ohio's Garden Sage. And we're talking about summer gardening. Listeners, we'd love for you to join the show. We're going to take your calls with your summer gardening questions. You can join us now, 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about whether or not we've had enough rain this summer. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Gardening can be relaxing. It can also be overwhelming at times. Ohio's weather fluctuations, knowing what plants to plant when can be confusing. But today we have two experts who can take questions and help us with our gardening knowledge. Here to answer our gardening questions, we have Mike Hogan, Extension Educator and Associate Professor of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Ohio State University. Thanks again for being here, Mike.
Glad to be here.
And Deb Kanapke, author, educator, and Ohio's Garden Sage. Thanks again for joining us, Deb.
Having fun as usual.
And listeners, we'd love for you to join us with your questions. Now's your chance. Ask Deb and Mike what's going on in your garden, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. While we wait for people to call, I'm going to ask the question that I teased. Deb, have we had enough rain this year?
So Mike and I were discussing that. And the answer is yes, with reservations.
Ish. We're adding an ish.
I always add an ish, yeah. Mostly because when we get rain, we get that half inch, that inch. That's fantastic. But when we get 2.5 inches at one point overnight, I had 2.5 inches. everything's so wet and I'm trying to figure out now what's my watering now. Okay, shift my watering for my tomatoes because tomatoes become sensitive to having too much water. You get cracking and then you get, and then you let them dry out too much and they get blossom end rot. And so it's been a mixed blessing when you get a lot. But then I know some folks who haven't had it. I was just in Michigan and there are some really dry areas where trees are dropping their leaves. So it's been a real hit or miss pattern. And personally, I can say my garden looks fantastic, but I don't know about everybody else.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, you've been on here on the show before talking about us being in a drought. And so we're doing okay now. This July and August is all right.
We're darn near close to average. At our weather station at Waterman Farm here in the Columbus campus of OSU, I believe we're about right at 28 inches. Historically, the average August 1st is 26 inches. So that's pretty good. Different parts of certainly Franklin County, but all of Central Ohio will have, you know, differences. You know, I've seen 2 or 3 inch differences between Hilliard and Gahanna, you know, and Grove City. But on average, we're doing pretty good precipitation wise. I mean, lawns are still green. Some people that don't like to mow, you know, look forward to that summer slump of turf grass. Haven't seen that, you know.
Yeah, no one wants to mow in July. Right. Yeah, right. But we've had enough rain.
Yeah. The downside is, you know, we are seeing some leaf type diseases, foliar diseases, mostly from the spring weather. You know, when it was a little difficult to get things planted and our gardening chores done when we had incidents of precipitation, we're seeing some leaf diseases, particularly on woody ornamentals, even some trees. I have a horse chestnut and a buckeye in my landscape, and both are very infected with leaf blotch disease that causes a pathogen that causes leaf blotch, simply because of the experiences we had, you know, 2 months ago.
Yeah. Deb, I'm going to ask the question, not that you can predict the future, but is the drought still coming? Are we going to have a really dry September or something like that?
And I always ask those questions too. What should I be preparing for in my garden? And we do have this active El Nino situation in the Pacific, which means when that's happening, usually the Ohio Valley gets sort of a hotter, drier summer. And we're not. So then I ask, well, why are we not? And part of me wonders if the wildfires, what we talked about earlier, had some impact, because particulate matter in the atmosphere can sometimes affect temperature. So was that a factor, or was it long enough to be a factor? Was it enough? I don't know. But I am fully expecting to have a drought and will be ecstatic if we don't.
Ecstatic if we don't. All right. Yes. You heard it here first. So, Mike, what are Ohio governors like? How is the corn crop going? You know, we talk about that. We've had the right amount of rain. Is the corn going to be good?
You know, for the first time in probably almost 36 months, the Ohio Drought Monitor, the map of Ohio, shows that we do not have any drought conditions at all. In the past, obviously, we're a large state. We're affected by different, you know, weather, depending on where close some of the northwestern counties that are close to Lake Erie, all the way south along the Ohio River, somewhere in the last two seasons, fairly well dispersed. We've had drought, abnormally dry conditions. At best. The most current drought monitor I saw for, I think it was dated August 1st, maybe Friday or Saturday data, was that there are no brown or yellow colors of any county in Ohio. And that's probably the first time in definitely in growing season, the last two or three growing seasons. So that's really a good thing. So, you know, it was difficult for some farmers, depending on where they were and where the rain hit. You know, sometimes spring and summer rains, they rain on one side of the township road and not the other side of the road. So very variable weather, you know, even, you know, for one particular farmer. You know, folks, some farmers had to mud in, what we call mudding in the crop, you know, planting it on wet ground that we don't like. Prefer, but we do, you know, during emergencies. But crops do look fairly well for this time of year.
We have an email from Chris. Chris sent an email wondering about pest control with his cucumber plants. He didn't say what pests, but what could be the problem with Chris's cucumber plants, and how can he save them?
Several different critters are very common to cucumbers.
Yeah.
I know some gardeners who just have quick growing cucumbers just because they were tired of dealing with mostly the cucumber beetle, two different types of cucumber beetles, striped cucumber beetles, spotted cucumber beetles, also flea beetles, smaller insects than those cucumber beetles can sometimes cause problems with cucumbers. But it's the cucumber beetles that are most troublesome. Sometimes what we can do is I like to plant those crops, even squashes, a little bit later in the season. I don't get excited about getting those planted in the ground the first thing because if we plant them a little later, we can miss the height of the populations of many insects that cause problem with vining crops like cucumbers and squashes. But those are the common culprits of cucumber crops.
All right, Deb, you want to add?
I do, and it's not cucumbers, but I planted late beans, you know, the small filet beans that are quick to come on, and I'm having a huge problem with flea beetles or bean beetles. I'm not sure which one it is because I haven't caught the little turkeys yet, but
but you know they're there.
They're there. They look like somebody just stuck all kinds of pins in. They're so holy. I'm not sure I'll get a lot of beans.
Yeah,
but it was a gamble. I'm pretty sure it's flea beetles.
Yeah, the size of the damage is usually the indicator. I've seen more bean leaf beetles this year, Deb, than flea beetles. Usually we grow a lot of eggplant, and they're usually riddled with flea beetles.
Yes.
However, flea beetles are more common when we have dry, hot temperatures. So we had those 100-degree days, but we really didn't have more than a week or 10 days of that this year, and we haven't been very dry. A lot of times those little insects like flea beetles simply just rain or irrigation from a sprinkler end of a hose, will knock them off the plants, and it'll be enough to get the plants to outgrow the damage. But we haven't seen too much damage from flea beetles. I have, however, seen bean leaf beetles on several different crops this year, more than normal.
So it makes me wonder, you know, the moisture helps. It's an advantage for some pests and not for others, same as the dryness.
Yeah.
And haven't seen a lot of spider mite damage.
No. And see, that would be very similar, I think, to flea beetles, you know, the smaller insects like that.
What do spider mites do? What do they go after?
Anything? Bean crops. Okay. Yeah, almost anything.
Yeah.
A lot of ornamental crops. They are very damaging to some of our evergreen or spruce trees. But again, they're most damaging during extended periods of hot, dry weather. They're a major pest of soybeans some years.
We have Bev in Pickaway County. Bev, what is your question? Bev's on the phone. Do you have the phone? There we go. Bev, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. There we go. What's your question?
Okay. I didn't get my baby rhubarb put in the ground. Excuse me. I got transplants. They were seedlings, so I can see that little crown is there. I'm going to put them in the ground regardless. So what do I want to be mindful of when I'm this late in the game?
All right. We're late on the rhubarb.
it doesn't matter. That's still a good time to plant. The biggest thing is that rhubarbs are hungry critters. Please use compost in the soil when you plant them, because if you don't, it's just going to limp along. And keep them evenly moist, but not overly wet. Don't let them dry out when they're in a young stage. And going into the autumn, just look forward to harvesting maybe one or two spears next year. Some people don't harvest their first year. Let the plants really come on. And so next year count as your first year as opposed to this one. So you might just let them grow next year and then harvest your rhubarb the second year.
And you want to add anything about rhubarb?
No, I think that's true. And just watch if we do turn dry, you know, make sure you give them a little extra moisture if the ground turns dry. But, you know, I think Bev's question is indicative of a lot of gardeners, especially in August. We get a lot of requests to do community programs, our master gardeners and myself, libraries and other groups throughout the community. And we had like this increased number for August on, and actually we had somebody requested for July presentation on the topic of preparing the garden for winter, you know, shutting down the garden. And I'm always like, my favorite
garden
gardening season is fall. You know, I'd much rather garden in August and September. I'd rather garden in a hoodie and jeans than being soaking wet t-shirt because of the humidity and the moisture. But think about all the things that really, all the plants, food crops especially, that prefer cool weather. Carrots, all of the greens, lettuces, green onions. Like Deb said, we're just starting to plant those now for our fall crops. Last year, we harvested our last carrots and beets on December 7th that we took to food pantries. And we were harvesting kale through the winter, you know, up until February. So I would encourage folks to not think about only shutting down the garden. Maybe you don't have to replant the entire garden or every bed. Certainly, we're not going to plant warm season crops, but it's a great time to plant cool season crops. If you've never had carrots that were in the ground during a frost, I would encourage you to try that this year.
Do they taste better?
They do taste better.
They're sweeter.
They're much sweeter because of the stored carbohydrates, you know, as a kind of antifreeze self-defense mechanism during cold weather. They are released and turned into sugars to prevent the cells from bursting. And so they are much more sweeter. That's why frozen carrots just you buy in the store are typically more sweeter than fresh carrots that you would get. And so same thing with beets. Can have an increased
Yeah, I love a garden science experiment. Yeah. Listeners, you can join us with your summer gardening question, and we can pivot from summer to fall as well. Let us know what questions you have. 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or send an email to allsides@wosu.org. We did get an email from Belinda in Galena. Her question was how to amend the soil to not get rust on tomato plants.
Rust.
What, I don't know what that, do we get rust on tomato plants? Yeah. Or I can't ask Belinda because it's not, she's not here.
It's not as common, but different different pathogens that cause rust are not uncommon. I'm not so sure that soil amendments per se have a direct effect on that. You know, a lot of the leaf diseases that are more common on tomatoes especially are soil borne. And so, you know, we can do some things to the soil, like covering the soil with mulch, pruning the lower leaves so there's less potential for infection when we have those raindrops hitting the soil and bouncing, you know, the disease spores up onto the plants. But I'm not sure.
What does rust on tomato plants look like? Does it literally look like rust?
It does. You know, it's common on certain plants. There are rust diseases of turf grasses. Again, we typically see those types of pathogens in greater numbers when we have more wet weather and more humid weather, which both of those have been rare this growing season.
614-292-8513 or send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. We are talking with Mike Hogan, Extension Educator at Ohio State University, and Deb Kanapke, Ohio's Garden Sage. This is your chance to ask them your gardening questions, so give us a call, 614-292-8513. And we'll continue with All Sides in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This hour, we are discussing all things gardening, from growing our own produce to what can grow in your yard as you head from summer into the fall. And here to answer your gardening questions, we have Deb Kanapke, author, educator, and Ohio's Garden Sage. Thanks for being here, Deb.
As always, it's fun.
And Mike Hogan, Extension Educator and Associate Professor of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Ohio State University. Thanks for being here again, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And we're going to go to Sarah in Columbus. Sarah, what's your question?
Hi, I'm in the Columbus area, and I'm just wondering, I do a lot of backyard gardening. My acorn squash got completely wiped out, I think, by squash bugs this year. And we pick off the eggs. We go out like every day or a couple times a week and pick off the eggs. But I was wondering if nematodes are all they are, you know, hyped up to be. Should I be using those in my soil for next year?
All right. You're gonna have to tell me what a nematode is, Deb. I don't know what that means.
It looks like a worm, but it's not a worm. Many of them are parasitic. They eat other things, and they're in the soil. And I've not heard of nematodes. I say nematodes, but you know,
well.
It's potato, potato.
All right.
It's potato, potato.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I've not heard of a nematode that goes after squash beetles because that's above ground. So nematodes go on, except for foliar nematodes on hostas, and that's a whole nother thing. But usually they're in the soil. What you're doing is good, but Mike...
Tell me about Sarah picking off the eggs of the squash bugs. Is that what she's supposed to be doing?
Oh, absolutely. That's the most effective thing. You know, and a lot of times they're on the underside of the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Very easy to see. Squash bug eggs are fairly large when we think about insect eggs.
They are.
But, you know, just tear off that section of the leaf with the eggs, throw it in your household trash, take a bucket of soapy water to the garden with mm-hmm. you and drop them in there. Another thing, you know, so many times when we think about controlling or controlling. We used to say eradicating insects. We're not going to eradicate insects. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we're not going to control insects. Best thing we can do is to figure out how to live with insects, right, when we're growing plants. And so I like to think about cultural controls. Certainly scouting, picking off those eggs, incredibly effective. Mm-hmm. Another thing to do, especially with squash bugs, which are very common, as I mentioned, maybe plant a little bit later. We don't want to go too late with winter squash because they take longer to develop, obviously. But planting a trap crop, we find research has shown that very specific winter squash called Blue Hubbard squash. It's a very large winter squash. My great-grandfather in upstate New York used to grow that when I was a kid, and they'd store them inside the farmhouse. They're as big as pumpkins type of thing, feed a whole family type of thing. But we have found by planting those at the edge of the garden, for some reason, the insects prefer that type of squash, and they are attracted to it. And
it'll leave your other squash alone?
Exactly. And you don't have to worry about harvesting. Your goal is not to harvest or grow the Hubbard winter squash, is to keep the squash bugs off your delicata or zucchini or yellow squash or whatever it is. So I always encourage people to think about cultural controls. Insecticides, especially chemical insecticides, should be our last tool that we use in the toolbox.
All right, we're going to hear from Carla in Grove City. Carla, what's your question?
I have three tomato plants, all different varieties. This is probably wrong, but I plant my tomatoes pretty much in the same place every year, and I get a big harvest generally. But one of the three this year is the biggest plant I've ever seen. It's over 6 feet tall. It is covered with blossoms and not a single tomato.
Mm. Does that surprise you, Mike?
No, that's not an uncommon occurrence. First of all, I don't know what varieties you have, but it is probably an indeterminate variety, which is different than determinate varieties of tomatoes in that it continues to grow in size and produce flowers. One of the worst things we can do with tomatoes, but especially indeterminate varieties, is continue to feed them nitrogen. Too many folks bring us plants into our clinic at the OSU Extension Office in Franklin County. They'll bring in a tomato plant just as she describes, you know, maybe 6 foot tall, lots of flowers, but maybe sometimes no flowers, or the flowers never set into fruit. And when I ask, you know, have you fertilized it all? Oh, someone who says, oh, yes, I fertilize weekly with high nitrogen, maybe liquid fertilizer like Miracle-Gro or something. That's not what we want to do, especially with those types of tomato plants. They certainly need a little extra nitrogen when they start to flower and develop fruit, but it's not the type of, we don't treat those plants the same as you might treat your impatiens or begonias that might benefit from a weekly or biweekly shot of fertilizer.
Yeah, Deb, tomato thoughts.
Tomato thoughts. So I don't use any liquid foliar feeds. When I plant them, I put compost in the area. And in the fall, I put leaves over the area and they break down over the winter and that gets incorporated with the soil too. So I'm trying to use more of a soil building technique rather than feeding them during the season. It's just a different way of doing it. There are so many different ways to garden and finding your best one. But I agree on the nitrogen. You know, I've been seeing some gorgeous plants and then I hear, well, I use this 20-20-20 and I'm thinking, oh boy, you know, it's just too much of a good thing.
We have an email from a person who didn't leave their name and they want to know, does the extension office have an arborist that is free to the public?
We don't have an arborist on staff, but we do have two extension faculty like myself that can help homeowners either diagnose problems with trees or, you know, suggest when and how they might contact an arborist to help them with tree issues. We get lots of tree issues, questions, people bringing leaves and whole branches into our, our clinic. We have a garden helpline that's staffed by our Master Gardener volunteers throughout the growing season. April through October. Used to be all in person 2 days a week. Is still in person 2 days a week, but most of our contacts come on the phone, come by email with digital photographs, and we can certainly help folks diagnose tree problems in their landscape. Mm.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking to Extension Educator Mike Hogan and Ohio's Garden Sage, Deb Kanapke. And there's still a few minutes left for you if you have a question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Again, that's 614-292-8513. I did want to spend some time to talk about native gardening because it seems like a trend that has grown into a career for people. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants their gardens to be native. Deb, you smiled real big. Talk to me about native plants because it is all the rage right now.
It is the rage.
Yeah.
I love native plants. I have a lot of them in my garden. I also have a lot of non-native plants. Mm-hmm. Where I draw the line is invasive plants. I will not plant a known invasive plant. Now, that's not to say that a plant will, I like to use the term click, and suddenly become overabundant, taking advantage of the environment. And the definition of an invasive plant is doing economic and environmental harm. And so we really need to look at that definition and realize that's what an invasive is, not just a little mint plant that likes to scurry through the garden. But back to native, there are some insects, other animals, etc., that depend on a specific plant. For mm-hmm. instance, goldenrod. There are 42 species of native bees that must have goldenrod in the environment or they have no food. Mm. So in that case, yes, I have goldenrods for them. But at the same time, I also have my lavender plants, which are not native to Ohio. And they are phenomenal pollinator plants. They are visited by generalist bees. I don't know of any specialist bees that visit them. And the bees, butterflies, lots of butterflies. So I think what it comes down to is understanding why you have native plants. Mm-hmm. And also the understanding that if you think you're putting things back the way they were, that's just an unrealistic goal. And I've heard some people say that that's what they're trying to do. There is no such thing as going back. We go forward in a garden. And so I think there is a beautiful marriage between our native plants and our non-native plants, depending on what you want them for. And I am a food and herb grower. And most of those plants are not native to Ohio, although I do have quite a few native herbs in my woodland garden. And I have, I do have raspberries.
So, I was just going to ask, so what is native? Raspberries?
Raspberries, pawpaws.
Yeah.
Okay, help me out here,
Wild
Mike. Wild strawberries, yes.
But maybe not what we want to eat.
Yeah, well, they're shorter periods of time, so you're going to kind of go hungry. and, you know, all that we you mentioned peppers. So that's Mexico, Southwest U.S. into South America and our tomatoes. So they're new world crops. So it depends on native to where. And also what it is you're trying to do in your garden. And I, and my last thought on that before letting Mike say something, if I haven't said everything, is that we're in a time of climate change. We don't know what we will, what will adapt to that. And so I'm keeping an open mind and an open heart to understanding the ecology and the environment and watching. I am constantly watching to see who visits what and what benefits the garden and the environment on the whole.
And Mike, your extension office is having what you're calling a fall native plant field day. And so tell us what people can learn if they attend this.
Yeah, as you said, certainly native plants have become more popular. We have a group of master gardeners. Master gardeners can become specialized in a specific topic. And we have a very large group that have recently become specialized in our statewide specialization program in native plants. One of the things we're going to do this fall on Saturday, September 12th, at this field day is we'll spend a little time indoors, but then we're going to go outside into our learning gardens, which Deb actually helped design probably 12, 14 years ago.
When was that?
Yeah, it was longer than both you and I had fewer gray hairs back
then.
But one thing we're going to concentrate on this fall, Amy, at this event is how to manage those herbaceous perennials in the fall and winter. There are several beneficial insects and some of the native bees that, that Deb mentioned that really depend on having those plants in the landscape, especially some plants like coneflowers, other plants with a hollow stem. If we, instead of just cutting those off at ground level and composting the plant residue, if we can leave those to spring, pop off the heads, that gives a place for beneficial insects and, like I said, native bees to overwinter. And we wait till spring before we remove those plants. And there are some other tricks and tools, but that's kind of going to be the focus, to go out into our gardens and look how we're managing the plants, not just for the plants and the environment, but to benefit the pollinators and beneficial insects.
Okay, we have 4 minutes left, so I'm going to try to get through a couple of questions. Bonnie wants to know where to find goldenrod.
Goldenrod is now becoming more popular in almost every garden center. Some of them, I will say, are pretty vigorous. But take a look at blue wreath or blue stem. I'm sorry, blue stem goldenrod, zigzag goldenrod, which can self-seed like a like a son of a gun. But you can take out the ones you don't want. Fireworks goldenrod, solar cascade goldenrod. They are all cultivars that have been chosen from wild populations.
So we can find seeds at a garden center.
You can find seeds and plants.
Just don't overwater them. I made that mistake. I treated them like some other herbaceous perennials in my bed, and I watered them too much, and they just didn't last and spread the way they should have. And I believe it was because I overwatered them.
And fertilize. Fertilize.
That's true. They require less fertility. Mm-hmm. They don't require that rich soil. Think about where they grow in the native environment.
Yeah, and Bonnie also wants to know. So if you plant the goldenrod, then the bees will just find it eventually.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. If you plant it, they will come. All right. Really quick, Stephanie in Clintonville. Stephanie, what's your question?
I have an elm tree, and I planted it in 2012, and it's starting to get the elm leaf miner sawfly, and I was told if I treated it in March, I wouldn't get the sawfly, but then I also will not have food for the birds to eat, right? Because they make little caterpillars, and I'm sure the birds eat them. So is it better to like let my tree suffer, because it seems to be getting a little worse every year, or do I treat it and like the poor birds won't get food?
Boy, that's a tough one.
Well, you know, it depends on the size of the tree or the age of the tree. You know, a newly planted tree, very small sapling, you know, a little bit of foliage loss, you know, will have an effect on its ability to store carbohydrates and put on growth, you know, and be ready for next spring. As that tree matures, and you say you've had it in the environment for a few years, I'm not so sure I get excited about sawflies. There are some specific sawflies that when they're present in great numbers can defoliate trees. But like you said, you know, a different ecosystem service, you know, providing a food source for the songbirds that we all know and love. And so I'm not so sure I would get overly excited unless you're getting them in such great numbers that you're, you know, a third, a quarter, a third of the foliage is defoliated.
All right, we have 30 seconds. Can you help Bill in Clintonville help his serviceberry bushes recover from the heat?
Compost. Mm. Not right up against the trunk, but a big ring of compost around. Water it in and sit under it and talk to it.
Serviceberries are funny. You know, I have a couple of different varieties in my yard, mm-hmm. and I swear they start to drop their leaves July 4th when the fireworks start, and they come back fine. They're pretty resilient. They're native, obviously, most of them, and they'll be fine.
Okay, so he's just maybe a little worried. All right. We've been talking with Mike Hogan, an extension educator and associate professor of agriculture and natural resources at Ohio State University. Thank you for being here, Mike.
Yep, glad to be here.
And thank you to Deb Kanapke, author, educator, and Ohio's Garden Sage. Thank you, Deb.
Nice to be here, as I said before.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us. You can listen back if you missed any part of today's show, wosu.org/allsides. Thanks.